paired with continued battlefield losses. Such an agreement, or even a gesture in that direction, might jumpstart negotiations for a lengthy ceasefire that stops attacks on civilians. Agreement on a ceasefire has one often overlooked downside: failure. Should many violations occur that lead one or both sides to lose trust in the process, the war is likely to resume with even greater intensity than before. Beyond that, there will be little hope of seeking a ceasefire again, or even a pause, or for that matter, an agreement of any kind. So those who arrange a ceasefire need to get it right the first time. Otherwise, talk about a peace settlement or Gaza's governance future is not just premature, it is hopeless. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 14th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow, Chris Gow, Josh Salem, Sam Bowman, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Michelle Coppola. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Farah Siddiqui, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, and have a great night.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. Today is part 3 of our Forests Over Profits series, featuring selected presentations from the Forests Over Profits conference that the Coast Range Association helped organize this past September. I am so excited for you to hear this talk by John Brush of the Cedar Moon Collective and Try On Life Farm, entitled, Should Anyone Own the Forest? From the Rights of Nature legal movement to community forestry, resurgent indigenous sovereignty, Brush shared a diverse and creative set of approaches that seek to undermine capitalist extraction as the primary human relationship with land. I really appreciated how Brush's approach made me think about forest ownership and relation to the land from a completely different perspective. If this show helps you find a different perspective or inspires you, please consider subscribing to Coast Range Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast app. Recommend us to a friend, and I would be so grateful if you would leave us a good review. You can also learn more about the Coast Range Association at coastrange.org, and my email is michael@coastrange.org. Before I turn it over to Brush, I want to dedicate this episode to the memory of Sean Jacobson. Sean was an incredibly passionate activist, permaculture practitioner, and an active member of many, many different organizing efforts throughout the Pacific Northwest. I knew Sean through our work with the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, which put on the Forests Over Profits Conference. So I know how bleak the world can often feel, and it can be hard not to feel hopeless sometimes. But there is always beauty in the world, and there is always something worth living and fighting for. If you're struggling, it is not your fault, and you are not alone. Please reach out to someone, whether it's a friend, or family member, a therapist, or as Maria Bamford says, any random stranger who will listen. Speaking of which, again, my email is michael@coastrange.org, and I've always got a willing ear to lend. If you know someone going through it right now, and I guarantee you do, please check in with them. Okay, thank you so much for listening. Let's get on with the show.
Okay, I'm really excited to introduce the next speaker, John Brush, who's a longtime activist with land-centered movements, both internationally and locally, a forest defender and legal worker. One of the things that Brush has helped do is create innovative approaches to community land trust models that integrate residential, agriculture, and habitat use. One of these was put into practice just up in Southwest Portland, the Cedar Moon community and Tryon Life Community Farm, and has been gone on to be replicated with many other land projects around the country. So like I said in the teaser, this talk delves into that question of ownership, right? We've been talking a lot about forests, but let's talk about what it means to own the land. And it shares frameworks and examples of commons land tenure that moves towards healing our relationships with the land rather than continuing the break.
Hello, everyone. I'm really grateful to be here. I want to start by expressing my gratitude to the people of this land since time immemorial. This is the Multnomah Chinook, whose villages were along the sides of this river. I want to give thanks to the forests that are here, the forests that are right up these hills that are in the nooks and crannies of this city, and the people that walk with those lands, the people that tend them and honor them, the houseless people, the walkers, the prayers. I want to give thanks to the ways each of us in this room are related to the land and are woven with it. Because I want to suggest today something that is underlying all the talks we've heard so far, which is that really what it's going to take is a revolution. It's going to take a profound and deep transformation of everything about how we as humans are related to the land. So for us as revolutionaries, as people of the earth, as those listening to the ancestors, the indigenous ancestors and indigenous accomplices, what matters most for us is how humans are in living practice relating to land. How are we weaving with the forest? How are we listening, dancing, tending, harvesting, burning, seeding, singing and praying? So I'm going to talk about property law, of course. Property law is about constructing fictions, but these fictions make it easier or harder for men with guns to escort bulldozers and feller bunchers, uprooting the complexity of the forest, uprooting the complexity of the relations of those humans woven with the land. So this talk is about how to make it harder for men with guns. We'll talk about laws and property interests, but we won't forget what really matters. Humans as part of the much more than human, humans as part of the forests. The nature of those living relations is change. The nature of law and property is change. Empire's law in general follows behind social and political struggle. That's what's primary. It evolves, and yes, to domesticate struggle, domesticate resistance, but in the law, there's also the traces of the victories of ancestors, and this is something that we can use. We can't rely on empire's law, but remembering and making use of the victories of the past helps us avoid problematic situations now. So, Chuck talked to us about rural lands, talked about the ways in which there's this sense that it's either Wall Street or it's governments that are still distant from the land. It's a truism in settler colonial society that politics is left or right. Leftists want the governments to control the forest, right? Regulation or policy. Rightists want private property to rule. But actually, when we're paying attention to the relations of the land and their trace in property law, we see something else. And that something else is another pattern. Humans, singly or together, becoming relatives of the forest, living and tending the land. Whatever legal form this takes, that pattern is what we seek. So, how does that happen? I'm going to oversimplify. Two different contrasting approaches to real property. On this side, something derived from Roman imperial law, land is the very same thing as material goods or domesticated animals. It's something that one person controls and owns, can do whatever they want with. On the other side, and this is something that is rooted in earthbound customary laws of all kinds, indigenous practices, many different ways of doing it, and also English common law, land is profoundly different. It is not something that can be alienated and turned around and controlled by single individuals. It's rooted in many different overlapping human and even more than human relationships, rights and responsibilities. So these two models, both of them deeply emphasize closeness to the land. And that's something that's really being lost. But these two models also are based in profoundly different cosmologies of how we are part of the world. On the one side, you have monoculture, atomized individuality. Everything, all value is convertible to money, right? Land is a transient commodity. On the other side, we have ecosystem, relations. Wealth is rooted in density of interconnections. Land is connection and responsibility. And the final way that we'll look at these two distinctions is using the very most common thing that every 1L property lawyer learns in law school, and that is that property is a bundle of sticks. On the one side, you have this bundle of sticks of different rights and responsibilities being all held with one person, or at most, a landlord and tenant, simple relationship. On the other hand, you have this bundle of sticks, which is a set of relationships, a set of ways that people are related to land, being widely diversified. Different kinds of entities and humans and groups have those relationships, have those connections. So, bundle of sticks held together tightly, alienable, can become disconnected from the land. On the other hand, woven relationships, woven connections that are part and parcel of what it means to be living. Okay, now, in the history of English and American property law, I'm just going to really briefly, this has changed. This idea of how land is related has changed profoundly and can continue to change and must change as a response to our revolution. Saxon law, people remember this way back when, 1,000 years ago, land was held in common. There was no property in land. After the Norman invasion, 1066, there was this introduction formally of Roman civil law, but in practice, for hundreds of years, common lawyers, quote, lavished their attention on the multiplicity of estates, tenures, and customary arrangements that concerned land. This was based on those ongoing struggles that people of the land in that time, 800, 900 years ago, contesting the rights of the lords, often at risk to life and limb. And this remains in the law now. Then, during the 15th and 16th centuries, people have heard of this, the enclosures. As a result of this push and this victory of the landlords and the emergent capitalists, property law was simplified back to that Roman idea of just being the same as alienable property, as a thing that you just can do with what you want. But then, in the 18th and 19th centuries, the pendulum kind of started swinging the other way. This is the result of this profound and violent imposition of colony, of colonization and empire all over the world. And this was, on the one hand, destructive, and there was this conquest, but on the other hand, it was constantly contested. People all around the world were refusing and resisting and fighting against empire. And in order to accommodate that, colonial administrators had to make treaties, they had to transform the rights between landlords and tenants, and property law changed again. That bundle of sticks was distributed more widely. Now, in the 20th and 21st centuries, we've seen the emergence of many legal movements that encourage the return of the commons and the rights of non-human life. And this is what we're part of. And this is not, again, the property law isn't going to lead us, we can't solve the problem with the law. But we can keep the men with guns further away. So, what are some of these movements? I'm going to kind of summarize a number of them. There's Aboriginal title, there's the insurgent return of indigenous communities seizing control of land. There's the Rights of Nature movement, which is related to that indigenous struggle, and which is introducing trees, mountains, and forests as legal persons. There's community forestry movements, and there's a wide variety of them. We'll touch on a few versions of that. We've heard a little bit about it already. There's community land trusts and their history, which is also rooted in struggle. There's easements, profits, covenants, and servitudes, cooperatives, nonprofits, and adverse possession. And these are all different ways in which the nature of property, the nature of how humans are related to land, can be formalized and keep the men with guns away. And then we're going to end with a couple of examples, really practical, tangible examples. We're going to try to run through this. Again, each of these could be their own long, long talk, but we're going to be short. But if you have further questions here or later, let's talk more. Okay, one more time. The right of the bundle of sticks of property. Separating it is beneficial. This is my thesis, right? Keeping it, many different entities are related to the land, and people are related directly, not at a distance. How can that be institutionalized? How can that be formalized? Well, traditionally, there's this idea that really you need one owner, you need one person, because if you don't, it's inefficient. People will lose track. There'll be too many different parties. They'll all be in conflict. What I'm suggesting here is that conflict can actually be of benefit to the land. Because different people with different rights and relationships will be able to notice problems sooner, either actions or inactions. They'll have the wherewithal to act on those problems, and they will be able to track the needs of the land itself from different perspectives. And there's many ways that this can be institutionalized, and we can talk about that. So, let's start where starting begins, right? Where the place that this all begins in this land is colonization. And this process of violently seizing the land from people that have been woven for it from time immemorial. We are in a time in which the struggle of the ancestors, which resulted in some cases in treaties, and in other cases in refusal to treat with governments, that struggle is returning and is giving us a profound opportunity to relate to land in a different way. Land back. Land back has been happening for generations, and land back is a movement which is alive right now. And this happens in a variety of ways. I would just touch on them. Treaty rights. Treaty rights are enforcing rights that have been often broken, broken promises, but now enforcing them as a way that actually distributes the rights of the land, not only on reservations, but across wide territories, all across this Turtle Island. But also new treaties. Right as we speak, new treaties are being organized and negotiated between governments and tribes. And then unceded lands are also being contested through direct actions and blockades, and also in community organizing. And what this does is it reminds us that this regime of property is not permanent, is not fundamental, is not unchangeable. And it allows people to see their direct action of establishing a relationship with the forest in partnership and in connection with an indigenous people that have tended those lands forever, that is what really matters, right? And that's something that is for us to establish and make outside of property relations. Okay. However, this indigenous resurgence has also led to things that were formerly thought impossible. You know, the rights of nature movement is giving standing, legal standing, to natural entities, to trees, rivers, and mountains. There's two versions of it. On the one hand, by constitutional or legislation allowing some people to file court cases on the behalf of natural beings. The other version is to actually make natural beings into corporate entities, to persons, and allowing them to have civil and commercial rights. People often talk about this as having started back in 1972 when Christopher Stone wrote this book called Trees of Standing, but really, that didn't change anything. What changed anything is the resurgence of indigenous communities in places like Colombia and Bolivia and Ecuador and New Zealand. New Zealand is one of the most widely touted examples recently because Parliament granted legal personhood to Te Arua National Park, to the Whanganui River, and to Mount Taranaki, right? Parliament in New Zealand granted this personhood, and now people are just trying to figure out, what does that mean? Who speaks for the land? Who and how do they do it? And but the thing that I want to emphasize there is this is not out of the goodness of Parliament's heart, right? This is because Maori communities, specific Maori communities in New Zealand, have been struggling for generations and have forced the hand of Parliament to now acknowledge their own cosmology, a different way of relating to the land in which the land is itself. It owns itself. And that's something that we have the opportunity to deepen here as well. Yes. Yes, it's worthy of honoring. So there's a lot of ways to do that. And we've heard about some of the community forestry movements. I just want to touch very briefly to say community forestry as an orientation began in the 70s and has seen an enormous amount of lip service, at least, throughout the world, and especially in tropical forests. The big challenge that a lot of people are focusing on now is it's one thing to give nominal title or nominal rights to the land to tribes and local community groups, to nonprofits and cooperatives, but what does it actually mean? What is the power that is actually being wielded and able to be wielded on the ground? So when people don't have security and it's not actually effective, when the landowners have de facto power, the big landowners or faraway entities or local thugs, you know, local big men that are actually controlling things, then it doesn't actually turn out to benefit the forests or the people. So this is the core question. What are the actual dynamics of those relationships? And, you know, we saw Alex point out to a wide variety of community forestry forms of tenure, and we'll talk about a couple of examples of that. But the overall lesson here is you got to look at the details. You got to look at it's always the ownership gives a you know, something to start with, but then it's like, how are you organizing and how are you building power and how are you building relationship with the land on an ongoing basis? Community land trusts are another model, and we've heard a little bit about that, but I want to emphasize that community land trusts didn't come out of nowhere. They were actually rooted in the 30s and the rise of worker movements, but really it was the 60s and the civil rights movement in the United States that led to the first community land trust in Georgia, which was established to support cooperative land tenure for black folk. And this is something that's often forgotten. A lot of people kind of think of community land trusts as a kind of more bougie thing. But the core of it is to support movements and communities in building collective, the commons, ownership and care of land. The core mechanism, if you're not familiar with this, is to separate the title of the land from that of the improvements and then allow people to use the land communally through leaseholds, lease contracts that restrict what people can do to make sure that it's within the interests of what the community decides. And that's generally used to keep land out of speculation, out of, you know, investment and then, you know, making huge profits. But it can also be used for many other reasons. And we were involved with supporting land to be kept as agricultural land or in habitat conservation or in sustainable forestry. Okay, community land trust. Now, another model that you've heard about probably are easements. And these are within a larger framework of easements, profits, covenants, and servitudes. And that's a set of words that actually directly come from the common law of 800, 900 years ago, the remnants of a plethora of overlapping customary tenures, including such things as the rights to berry picking, hunting, firewood, the right to travel across or stay within land. It's about relationships to land, ongoing relationships, rooted. Not from it far, but people who walk the land, people who listen to the land, people who connect with it. And legally, these are rights and responsibilities that pass with the land and not through a contract between specific parties. So they're woven with the land. There's a wide latitude and it's growing. This has become increasingly common all throughout property law. And if you think of condos and HOAs, that's actually this resurgence of distributing the bundle of sticks through these different property interests, but also conservation easements. Okay, now how do you actually hold the different, these rights, the bundle of sticks? You have cooperatives, we've heard about that. There's many different ways to establish cooperatives. You can establish them as cooperative corporations, as LLCs, even unincorporated associations. But the key, as we've talked about again, over and over again, is how does it actually work? How are the relationships between the people and with the land actually managed? How do people enter and leave? How do decisions get made? And can rights be purchased and sold? So there are a lot of nuances to how cooperatives function. Another model that you've heard a lot about is nonprofits, right? So this sounds great. But again, the devil's in the details. Nonprofits can have two models. It can be member-managed or non-member, and where the board is self-perpetuating. And most nonprofits are like that, almost all of them. And so when you have a board that's self-perpetuating, what is the way in which that nonprofit is actually representing the community? Or can it be seized back by local power brokers? I want to, again, over and over again, return us to the sense that what really matters is organizing. What really matters is the relationships that people have with each other. What really matters is ourselves as parts of the forest. So that points to the last version of property law that I want to emphasize, and that's adverse possession. Adverse possession, what's that? Squatters' rights. Squatters' rights? What? Is that law? Squatters' rights, okay? So adverse possession is this kind of, it seems like, what does that even mean? What could that be? Just seizing land and then it becomes yours? Yes. Yes. And this is an ancient right that's been, still remains enshrined in property law in every U.S. state. What it says is that if people are relating with the land, are having direct, active, ongoing, notorious, open and notorious, quote, ownership, which means relationship with the land, then after some time, 5 to 20 years, they become the owners of that land. All right. This is not used very often for various reasons, but there's critiques of it because it can be seen as prioritizing capitalist and developmentalist extractive uses. But that's up to us because it can also be recognition that what really matters, what matters most, is how people are relating to the land on an ongoing basis, not far off at a distance. Okay. Now I'm going to touch on 4 different examples. That's right, wrapping it up. Number 1, land back. In the East Bay, There's Sogorate Land Trust. Sogorate Land Trust is indigenous and Ohlone-led, and its entire function is to hold different parcels of land that host community projects. And a specific example is a partnership between the Land Trust and a group called Movement Generation, which is a black and brown organization focused on land-based liberation. Movement Generation got the money to buy 43 acres to build a land tenure and education center. They could have bought it outright, but instead, they partnered with the Land Trust so that there's a built-in relationship with indigenous ancestors and with elders' wisdom. And then through a contract between the two different entities, they're able to have a bundle of sticks separated and distributed and held more broadly, more like an ecosystem. Model one. Model two, I'll really briefly touch on this. We heard about community forests, and a couple other in Washington are the Mount Adams Community Forest and the Klickitat Canyon Community Forest, which are right next to each other. Mount Adams is owned by a nonprofit. This nonprofit has been around for decades. It has many different stakeholders in the community, and it's this active relationship with the community that makes it really community forestry. And then the government said, okay, we want to do another community forest right next to you. We can't give that to a nonprofit because we're government. It's going to come from government money. So they established the Klickitat Canyon Community Forest. It's a state-run DNR, but they developed a management plan which basically mimicked that of the nonprofit-based community forest and drew into the community that way. The question is, government can change that. The government can change the advisory committee. Is that power really, does that really remain? So that those are some of the nuances that you're going to find when you really start developing community forest practices. Okay, another model, and that is in Scotland. And that is that people may know that between the 18th and 19th centuries, 90% of the population of the Highlands of Scotland were forced off the land. And that only ended in the late 19th century when the people of Glendale in Scotland rose up, faced down the Royal Marines, hundreds of Royal Marines, and eventually created an uprising across all of Scotland that forced the government to back down, to stop enclosures, and ultimately to return the land to the people. And in Glendale, right now, for the government was forced to provide a 50-year mortgage and low interest rates so that the people were able to take back control of the estate, which the landlord had held. And now it's held as a cooperative on the land in Scotland, right? And this is, again, the result of direct community mobilization and power. Here in Portland, another model is TLC Farm. I'll just really summarize this, the exact structure of it. There's a land trust, OSALT, and it owns a 99-year, there's a 99-year renewable ground lease between that and a nonprofit, as well as a cooperative. And those, the nonprofit and residential worker cooperative share management of the land. They have contractual agreements and tenancy in common. And one of the two collectives is an indigenous-led organization, and there's an indigenous-led elders council that addresses conflicts. Contracts include an arbitration clause in which the interests of the land are explicitly prioritized when deciding disputes. And practices include inviting people to listen to the land and speak in a respectful way, with the land directly playing a role in decisions. Then the last example I want to just offer is the MST, the Movimento Sem Terra in Brazil. Since the 80s, perhaps the largest land-based social movement in the Americas with 1.5 million participants. And its core tactic is what? Anyone know? The MST? Sem Terra, yes, with people without land. So it's a movement of people without land. Its core tactic is direct seizure and occupation of land. And they've done this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, with thousands and thousands of people being returned to the land. And it's a tactic that not only allows them to actually secure land for people in perpetuity, and not only for the period of time that they're actually occupying it, but actually to, quote, build a new way of life in which sharing and cooperation are the foundation. And this has gone on for over generations now, and it does not presume that the primacy, the primary side of struggle is the legislature, the court. Where is it? It's among people and the land becoming part of the forest. So the long name is Movimiento de Trabajadores Rurales Sem Terra. It's Portuguese. So rural workers without land in Brazil. So there's lots more to drill down in each of these. And so the question is, who will own the forest? Who's going to own the forest, folks? The forest is going to own the forest. And our relationship to the forest is because we are part of it, because we are woven with the forest itself, not via legal writ, but through that web of connection. Not dominant or transcendent, but humble and respectful and dignified. And through struggle, Empire's Law can be forced to recognize aspects of this, bit by bit, breaking apart the bundle of sticks, making room for ecosystems of us as part of the land. So might it be.
And that's it for today's episode of Coast Range Radio. You can learn more about Brush's work by checking out the show notes in this episode's podcast feed or at coastrange.org. We'll be back in a couple weeks with an exciting episode on the ongoing Dakota Access Pipeline fight, as well as a timely update on the Elliott State Forest. You can find that and all of our episodes by subscribing to Coast Range Radio on any podcast app or check in with your community radio station to see if and when they air Coast Range Radio. If you like what we're doing, please recommend this show to your friends. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you soon.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
From applicant tracking systems to chatbots to facial recognition, artificial intelligence is transforming our world for the better and also for the worse. Tune in Thursdays at 9 a.m. for The Imaginary Possible, a show that looks at the captivating potentials and the troubling realities of artificial intelligence today. Only on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself,